From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Today, a show drug companies don't want you to hear. Herbal medicine, a survey of medicinal plants and their uses.
Why drug companies are, by and large, very unhappy about herbal medicines is because, with some exceptions, you can't patent herbs. They can be grown in your backyard. You discover something about it, and you publish a research paper about a particular herb, and anyone else around the world is then free to be able to do that.
Also, Race, Crime, and the Law, Part 1, A History of Unequal Protection.
For much of the history of the United States, black people have been deprived of the equal protection, and I underline the word protection, of the law. For example, in slavery times, the slavery era, for a long period of time, black people could be murdered, and it was not even viewed as a crime.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Warning prosecutors and defense lawyers that he didn't want his courtroom to become the scene of a lynching, Judge Richard Matsch rejected highly emotional evidence on whether Timothy McVeigh should be put to death for the Oklahoma City bombing. The jurors, who on Monday convicted McVeigh on 11 counts of murder and conspiracy, had the day off yesterday. They returned to start hearing evidence on the penalty for the bombing today, which killed 168 people and injured hundreds more in the federal building on April 19th, 1995. This news from New York. Betty Shabazz's 12-year-old grandson told police he tried to kill her in the hope he would be reunited with his mother. This according to the New York Daily News. As his grandmother lay in a hospital bed covered in cream and gauze, Malcolm Shabazz appeared with his mother in family court yesterday to answer charges he set the fire in her apartment that badly burned her. He chatted quietly with his mother, Kabila Shabazz, during the hearing in which a judge ordered a medical and psychological evaluation for him. Again, Betty Shabazz lies in very critical condition with third-degree burns from the fire early Sunday in her Yonkers apartment. Betty Shabazz, the widow of Malcolm X. And you're listening to Democracy Now! More and more people are turning to alternative medicine because of soaring health care costs, but also because of their health. Today on Democracy Now!, we're going to take you on a journey through the world's plant life, but not just any ordinary journey. We're joined by herbalist Andrew Chevalier for a special exploration of plants and their healing properties. Andrew Chevalier is a leading figure in the field of herbal medicine. He runs his practice in London, England, is the past president of the National Institute of Medical Herbalists. He just published recently a comprehensive study on herbal medicine called The Encyclopedia of Medicinal Plants, a practical reference guide to more than 550 key medicinal plants and their uses. Can you tell us, Andrew Chevalier, about your book, The Encyclopedia of Medicinal Plants?
All, without exception, have medicinal properties. If you think of the parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme, all of them are priceless medicines sitting on your shelf or growing in your garden. Parsley is a good urinary antiseptic. It's a useful herb to take if you've got cystitis or your urinary tract infections. It helps the body to eliminate urates and oxalates that accumulate in things like gout and some kinds of arthritis. So it's certainly classically used for a variety of joint problems.
But before you tell us about that, Andrew Chevalier, let's get an overview of the world of medicinal plants, if you tell us overall about your survey.
Briefly, it's an attempt to put together a book that gives an introduction to medicinal plants from all over the world. So although it's definitely biased towards European and North American herbal medicine, it introduces the reader to herbal medicine from Asia, from China. China and India, from Africa, and so on.
What do you mean by medicinal plants?
Well, it's been estimated, or one estimation is that of the 250,000 flowering plants in the world, something like 70,000 of them have been used medicinally at some time or other. So it really means it's simply a plant that has been used to treat ill health or to enhance health in some way or other at some point in time. But obviously the herbs that I looked at in the book are ones that have either been used historically or, more importantly, are used today as important as medicines in their own right.
Let's talk about some of these medicinal plants that may surprise people. What are some of the most significant plants that you use as an herbalist, or as you say in Britain, as a herbalist?
That's right. Well, some of them will be known to everybody. Garlic, ginger, lemon. These are all very important medicinal plants, and although we think of them as foods or flavorings that are providing nutrition, they're also having often quite profound effects on how the body works. And then at the other end of the scale, there are things that professionally trained herbalists will use, like deadly nightshade or jimson weed, that will have a strong and potentially poisonous effect unless they use it exactly at the right dose.
Before we talk about what deadly nightshade is, what about ginger, garlic? What are their properties? How can they be used medicinally?
Well, one of the things I'm usually happiest to recommend people to use for flus and colds, because it's such an easy mixture to make up. Most people have these foods in their kitchen on a regular basis. So if you're coming down with a bad cold or a flu, you can use garlic and ginger and lemon all together. Get a clove of garlic, crush it up, a piece of fresh ginger root and chop it up, or some dried ginger, juice of a fresh lemon, and a teaspoonful of honey. Mix it all together with hot water, and you've got a really good medicine for helping to relieve the worst symptoms of a flu, and also to speed up recovery.
Why does that help?
Well, garlic, there are something like over 1,000 research papers have been written on garlic by now, and it's clearly got an ability to treat bacterial infection, to counter viruses, and it helps to make one sweat, so it'll help to lower temperature to some degree. Ginger is very good for the stomach. It's antiseptic, helps to make one sweat. Lemon is cleansing, lots of vitamin C. Honey has got antibiotic properties in it, soothing for sore throats, because sugar and honey help to coat and protect the throat. So in combination, you've got a mixture that's good for the chest and the throat and the stomach all in one go.
I'm looking at the beginning of your book, The Encyclopedia of Medicinal Plants, where you talk about the active constituents or ingredients of some common foods, really, that we eat. For example, radishes and lemon. Can you talk about, in each case, what is the active ingredient and what it actually acts on?
Well, in the case of garlic, garlic and ginger both have essential oils. There are various theories about how garlic works, but it's thought, well, the most plausible one at this point in time is that when you crush garlic, when it's exposed to the air, the essential oil is changed, and it creates and releases constituents which are profoundly antiseptic. We could say that they're natural antibiotics. There are a large range of active constituents in garlic, and they're responsible for a whole host of different ways in which one can use garlic as a medicine. I've referred to its use for infection, and you can certainly use it for bronchitis. Until the growth, the development of antibiotics garlic was used extensively for antiseptic dressings. For example, in the First World War, it was taken as probably one of the main treatments for bronchitis and pneumonia. It's good for digestive infections. But research now has shown that it helps to keep the blood thin and to lower blood pressure, and it positively affects the level of fat in the blood, so that it will help to lower cholesterol levels.
Does it matter how they're used? I mean, you talked before about crushed garlic, or in the case of radishes, do you crush them? Do you just eat them whole? Should they be cooked? Should they be raw?
You're generally going to want, I mean, horseradish obviously can be eaten fresh, but it is very acrid. It burns. Anyone who's ever tried eating horseradish in large quantities will know that you just can't carry on doing it because it gets too hot. But it's one of these interesting herbs that if you eat horseradish sauce or fresh horseradish, you get this intense heat building up in the top of the mouth and in the nasal passages. And one of the uses for horseradish is actually to treat hay fever. The old traditional remedy was to grate some horseradish root and eat it in a sandwich, and it seems to have the ability to stimulate blood flow to the nasal passages that are most irritated in conditions like hay fever.
Because it's so hot, can it burn a hole in your stomach? Are there dangers, for example, if you have an overactive thyroid, of having too much of a radish?
If you had an underactive thyroid, it would be a problem because it tends to lower, it tends to depress thyroid function to some degree. But it would be very difficult to have too much. Clearly, if you're someone who's got a stomach ulcer or is prone to a very acidic digestion, it's not going to be a suitable plant for you. Huh. But by and large, all these hot, spicy, acrid herbs like chili, cayenne, pepper, ginger, horseradish, in normal amounts, they're not going to cause any significant problems.
What about lemons and the flavonoids in them? How is lemon therapeutic?
Well, lemon, I mentioned earlier that it has obviously has a lot of citric acid. It's got a high vitamin C content, so it's vitamin C is essential for good health, and it's essential also for maintaining a healthy resistance to infection. Lemons also, as you rightly say, have a lot of flavonoids, a lot of bioflavonoids. And those have an antioxidant activity in the body. It means that they help to prevent the destruction of tissue in the body by pollutants and other chemicals that can get into the body and combine with the body's cells, but also it helps to support the integrity of the blood vessels, in particular the small arteries and capillaries. It helps to, the bioflavonoids help to keep the internal lining of the blood vessels smooth and to prevent them spitting. Many people get easy bruising. If you get that situation where you look down at your arm and you've got a bruise and you've got no idea how that bruise got there, that's quite possibly due to capillary fragility, that the capillaries are breaking easily. And foods and medicinal plants such as lemon, the bioflavonoids in these plants are extremely helpful at helping to reverse that kind of problem.
We're talking to Andrew Chevalier, an experienced medical herbalist and leading figure in the field of herbal medicine. He runs his own private practice in London. Andrew Chevalier is a past president of the National Institute of Medical Herbalists and currently chair of the Council of Complementary and Alternative Medicine. He's written a very significant book, not to mention beautiful and how it's laid out, The Encyclopedia of Medicinal Plants, a practical reference guide to more than 550 key medicinal plants and their uses. I was interested in the part of your book where you talk about the history of herbalism, where you talk about the fact that there was a period in the last century where herbalism was outlawed. Can you talk about the evolution of herbalism?
Well, I think that the relationship between herbalism and what we call orthodox or conventional medicine has been very complicated over the last 200 to 300 years. Even in the 1930s, something like 90% of the medicines that you get in a chemist or you'd be prescribed by your doctor would actually be from plants. They'd be herbal medicines in that sense. But on a more specific level, herbs used by people who call themselves herbalists, there's a major difference, if you like, between the conventional approach that's evolved over the last 150 years and the use of plant medicines by herbalists. The situation in the USA in the 19th century is quite a good example that even at the turn of the century, that I believe there was something like 8,000 medically qualified herbal practitioners who were called eclectics, and there were quite a number of herbal medical schools that were recognized, that the practitioners who graduated from these schools were recognized as medical practitioners, as MDs, but they were herbalists, and they were extremely skilled, and in fact they had a major influence on the development of herbal medicine here in the UK. In fact, the tradition of medical herbalism that I belong to is very much an Anglo-American tradition. There's always been interchange of ideas and of use of plants in that tradition for at least the last couple of hundred years.
One of the issues that we deal with quite extensively on Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily national news magazine that you're on right now, is the issue of corporate control of knowledge. What about pharmaceutical companies and their effect on the whole practice of herbalism?
Why drug companies are, by and large, very unhappy about herbal medicines is because, with some exceptions, you can't patent herbs. They can be grown in your backyard. You discover something about it, and you publish a research paper about a particular herb, and anyone else around the world is then free to be able to do that because it can't be patented. And so drug companies are, in that sense, not interested in using the whole plant. Their focus is very deliberately on using isolated chemical extracts from plants. Obviously, the most famous and most quoted example is aspirin. Aspirin actually doesn't come directly from a plant. You can get aspirin-type substances from herbs like willow bark and from meadowsweet. But it does actually require a chemical process from the salicylates within these herbs in order to get aspirin. But that's a good example that the isolated chemical extract doesn't have necessarily the same effect on the body as the whole plant. And in fact, meadowsweet, which is a common British plant, is a very good illustration of this. If you take a lot of aspirin or aspirin-type medicines, typically older people take them for joint pain and arthritis. One of the immediate problems is that aspirin causes inflammation of the stomach, leading to gastritis and erosion of the lining of the stomach, and that can lead on eventually to an ulcer. One of the extraordinary things is that meadowsweet, because it contains these natural aspirin-type substances and a whole range of other constituents, in particular tannins, which are astringent and tighten up tissue, meadowsweet can be used not exactly as a substitute for aspirin, because its level of activity is much milder, but it can be used to help to significantly relieve joint pain. It's also used simultaneously to help to heal the stomach and reduce excess acidity and return an acidic and troubled digestive system back to normal. So there's a simple example of the way in which the complexity inherent in natural plant product, in natural plants, means that they're available for use within the body in a very complex way, and the body often is able to utilize different aspects of constituents within the plant to achieve the actual rebalancing that particular person needs. The whole ethos of the drug company's search of the pharmaceutical industry is to find an isolated chemical which has demonstrable effect, but usually carries with it the downside of having demonstrable side effects. And herbal medicines, if they're used sensitively by people who know what they're doing, are generally speaking extremely free from side effects.
Andrew Chevalier is chair of the Council of Complementary and Alternative Medicine in Britain. He's an experienced medical herbalist. His book is The Encyclopedia of Medicinal Plants, a practical reference guide to more than 550 key medicinal plants and their uses. He started off by talking about parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme, and we're going to come back to talk about that in a minute here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Scarborough Fair. Parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme. Remember me to one who lives there. She once was a true love of mine. Parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme.
This is Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. We're continuing now with our exploration of the medicinal qualities of plants with herbalist Andrew Chevalier. He's a leading figure in the field of herbal medicine and presently runs his own practice in London, England. Andrew Chevalier is also the past president of the National Institute of Medical Herbalists. He's just recently published a comprehensive study on herbal medicine called The Encyclopedia of Medicinal Plants, a practical reference guide to more than 550 key medicinal plants and their uses. Andrew Chevalier, let's talk about standard herbs like parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme, herbs that people might have in the kitchen but don't necessarily think have medicinal properties.
All, without exception, have medicinal properties. If you think of the parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme, all of them are priceless medicines sitting on your shelf or growing in your garden. Parsley is a good urinary antiseptic. It's a useful herb to take if you've got cystitis or urinary tract infections. It's helps the body to eliminate urates and oxalates that accumulate in things like gout and some kinds of arthritis. So it's certainly classically used for a variety of joint problems. It's very rich in vitamin C and iron, so it's a useful herbal supplement, really, for people who are anemic. And in fact, you can consider garlic as a kind of natural herb supplement. It's got such a wide variety of constituents. That's one. If you think about thyme has got a very strong essential oil within it. It's the main active part of the plant. It's very antiseptic. It has a strongly antifungal activity. So you could make a tea up with thyme and put that on ringworm or on thrush, or you could use it as a mouthwash or gargle. It's also a good tonic herb. It's a tonic herb for the digestion. It'll help to settle wind. But it's got a persistent traditional reputation as a herb that, if you take small amounts of it regularly, will help to maintain health and support a healthy existence into old age. I can go on. Rosemary, there's been recent research into rosemary which has shown that its flavonoid content and its and many of its other constituents are so strongly antioxidant that it's possibly the best natural method of preventing oils from going rancid. So it actually stops oils from being broken down and going off, helps to retain them in their natural state, meaning making them retaining their nutritional value. And it will have that effect to some degree within the body as well.
I'm looking at your herbs and body systems, a chart of the various systems and what helps, and it says rosemary supports and strengthens the nervous system, and that relaxants for the nervous system are lemon balm, which relaxes the nervous system, a sedative is mistletoe, which reduces nervous activity, and a stimulant is the kola nut.
Yes. It's one of the most interesting areas of herbal medicine, I think, that different plants don't just affect one on a kind of physical level, but they do have a direct effect on, some extent, on mental and emotional state and energy levels. And rosemary is one of those herbs that is a good tonic stimulant herb to the nervous system. And there is research which tends to really confirm this. It increases arousal and ability to concentrate. It's thought that it improves the blood flow to the head, and by doing that enables one to have better concentration and recall memory. In the tradition of the classical world in ancient Greece, students used to wear bunches of rosemary leaves in their hair when they were sitting exams to help them to remember well. But certainly, if you're involved in studying and you've got exams coming up, drinking rosemary tea in the morning is something that's likely to significantly improve your ability to revise well and to cope with the demands of writing exams.
Now, you talk about these different herbs and how they help, but does it matter how you take them? For example, rosemary, does it matter if it's cooked? Do you take it raw? How do you eat these? How do you ingest these herbs?
Well, you can simply enjoy rosemary for its flavor and have it in food. If you're just using a very small amount, it will probably not have any, it'll only have a negligible effect. If you're wanting to actually get a medicinal effect from the plant, generally speaking, the simplest way to use the herbs at home is to make an infusion, which is just the same as making an ordinary cup of tea. And in something like rosemary, if you've got the dried rosemary, you'd want to use about a level teaspoonful of dried rosemary leaves. If you've got the fresh rosemary, a sprig or a heaped teaspoonful of the leaves. And put that in a small teapot or in a cup. Pour on a cupful of boiling water. Give it a good stir and then make sure you cover. Put the lid on the teapot or cover the cup. Herbs such as rosemary, lemon balm, chamomile, peppermint have got strong essential oils, and the activity of the plant is linked very closely to the amount of essential oil that you manage to drink. So if you make your rosemary tea in an open cup, you'll still get some benefit, but you'll have lost quite a lot of it in the steam that goes into the room. So you want to leave it for about 5 to 10 minutes and then strain it, and you can flavor it with honey if you like, and then drink it. It's probably best to drink it while it's warm, but you can leave it to cool. And in most cases, you would probably go for about a cup, 2 or 3 cups of a herb a day. But rosemary is one of those herbs that you would want to have mostly in the morning, because it's a waking, arousing herb, and you wouldn't want to take rosemary. It would be pretty counterproductive to drink rosemary just before going to bed. It would waken you up, and you probably find it difficult to get to sleep.
Moving from the nervous system to circulation and heart, you've got a picture here of cayenne. How does that affect the circulation and heart, and how do you think this should be taken?
Well, cayenne is an extremely interesting herb. It's, we call it simply a circulatory stimulant, and anyone who's ever tasted cayenne pepper knows that it is very hot, and wherever it comes in contact with the body, it leads to an increase in blood flow to that area. If you accidentally get some hot chilies, hot cayenne pepper, and get it on your fingers or on your cheeks, they will glow and tingle for several hours probably. What's going on there is that there is an irritant effect which is leading to blood being attracted and drawn to the area. So you can use it, cayenne to locally on the surface of the body to bring blood wherever that might be needed. And also the heat, there's a constituent within cayenne pepper called capsaicin, which is actually has an anesthetic analgesic effect. It leads to desensitization of the nerve endings, so that despite the fact that the initial sensation is heat and perhaps shock, quite quickly it leads to reduction in pain. So much as people may find it strange, herbalists often give people, along with a mixture of other herbs, cayenne pepper for sore throats, because it helps firstly to improve blood flow to the area, so that will help to counter the infection, but secondly it numbs the throat and helps to relieve the discomfort that's associated with it.
And how do you take that cayenne?
Well, the simple way then would be to get some chili sauce. If you get some good quality chili sauce, and just have it in your meal, just have it with your food, even a few drops in your meal regularly. If you're someone who's prone to getting poor circulation to the hands and feet, prone to getting cold hands and feet, then having a bit of chili sauce in your diet will undoubtedly help. If that isn't enough, you can get cayenne pepper capsules, and then that will be usually extremely effective. Not something to take necessarily if you live in a hot climate for that reason, but cayenne pepper obviously is eaten a lot in tropical areas, because it's also stimulates stomach acid production, and it helps to disinfect the whole of the digestive system, helping to reduce the onset of digestive infections such as dysentery and so on. And then finally, coming back to the circulation, it stimulates any increased blood flow throughout the body, and would be used herbally for anyone who's got an under-functioning, an underactive circulatory system. Although you know, it wouldn't be for someone who's got high blood pressure and a high pulse rate. It's for people who need a bit of heat. They need a bit of stimulation to get them going.
You may have heard that in this country, in the United States, a third of the population, I believe, is estimated to be fat or perhaps even obese. What about herbs that help people control their weight? We've just seen a study that shows that people who are taking various diet pills like fenfen and others, these are very dangerous and can be fatal. Is there a natural way for people to deal with this real crisis in American public health, and that is obesity and just being fat?
Well, I think I have to say that the short answer there is that there isn't an easy answer, but there are some things that can help. If obesity is a problem, then the two fundamentals I don't think can be avoided, and they are to try to change the diet to make it to give it a better balance, and to keep the actual quantity under control. And then the other side, obviously, is the level of exercise. If you don't manage to burn up what you're taking in, then eventually it will get put down as fatty tissue. I guess the best advice is to stick to eating as far as possible lots of fruit and vegetables, whole grains, and obviously the standard advice to cut down on very starchy, refined foods, sugars, and fatty foods. But foods such as seeds and nuts contain good quality oils that the body needs, and those are ones that one should actually think about increasing. They're going to be providing the kind of fat that the body needs to be able to be fit and healthy. It's by and large animal fats that one needs to avoid, and vegetable fats in moderation will be only helpful.
I wanted to ask about the effect of coffee and chocolate, two drugs you could probably say that a lot of people rely on to keep going.
Coffee and chocolate are, of course, in their own way, a medicinal plants. We don't see them like that, but they are plants that have a very definite action on the body. And coffee has been used to help to relieve headaches. The problem is not so much coffee as people taking coffee in large amounts day in, day out. If you were just to use it on an occasional basis, it wouldn't be a problem. But herbalists certainly see coffee as being a stimulant that leads to exhaustion. Classically, we all reach for a cup of coffee at the point where we're feeling exhausted and need something to keep one going. And that's the point where coffee starts to become exhausting. It stimulates the body into further activity, but it doesn't replenish the resources that are being called on at that point in time. So one can get into a vicious circle where the vitality of the body is slowly being sapped by coffee. And if I can think of an example, I've seen by now, I would say, dozens and dozens of women who've suffered from bad period pains and premenstrual problems. And the simplest thing that can be done to help to reduce those problems often is simply to cut out tea and coffee.
Would you say that the reason there isn't that much research done into pharmaceuticals, for example, in this country, is because corporations are largely behind the research and they don't have anything to gain financially by researching, as you said, these more generic herbs, which are often the basis of their drugs, but they're just brought to us in a different form so that we have to pay more money?
Well, yes. I mean, I think in most of the Western world, until the last 10 or 15 years, herbal medicine was regarded as either rather irrelevant or as a hark back to times before science had sorted the medical world out. That view has changed a lot, and there is now beginning to be a very major amount of research into medicinal plants. Germany and China are probably the two countries at the forefront of research into herbal medicine.
Andrew Chevalier, we have to go now. Thank you very much for joining us. Andrew Chevalier is a leading figure in the field of herbal medicine. He's the author of the Encyclopedia of Medicinal Plants, a practical reference guide to more than 550 key medicinal plants and their uses. It's published by DK Publishers in New York. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. Listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman, and we're joined by Professor Randall Kennedy. He's a professor at the Harvard Law School. He was a former law clerk to Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall, and he's written a new book called Race, Crime, and the Law. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
Well, why don't we start off with the history you give of unequal protection?
The book begins with two historical sections, and the first historical section focuses on the underprotection of the law. For much of the history of the United States, black people have been deprived of the equal protection, and I underline the word protection, of the law. For example, in slavery times, the slavery era, for a long period of time, black people could be murdered, and it was not even viewed as a crime. It was viewed as a tort, so a killer of a slave would have to pay a fine to the owner of the slave, but it was not viewed as a criminal offense. It took, in some jurisdictions, it took 100 years or more for the killing of a slave under certain circumstances to be viewed as a punishable criminal offense. During the antebellum era, rape in most places was never a criminal offense, the rape of a slave. One of the more horrendous cases that I came across in my research for this book was a case in which a slave had raped a 10-year-old girl and was prosecuted, and the prosecution was voided by the Mississippi Supreme Court, which ruled that since there was no statute that explicitly prohibited the raping of a slave. There was no criminal violation. And so the Mississippi legislature then passed a law that made it a criminal violation for a slave to rape a slave or a black person to rape another slave over or under the age of 12. And so note that there was a racial designation and an age designation, which still left most slave women, most black women in Mississippi at the time, without the protection of the law when it came to sexual offenses. So after the abolition of slavery, black people still suffered from under protection of the law, the most egregious example being lynching. Between 1890 and the 1930s, there were thousands of lynchings of blacks for racially motivated reasons, mostly in the South. And in the overwhelming majority of those cases, nothing was done about this criminal victimization of black people. That's sort of the history that that I unfold at the very beginning of the book.
Then you talk about Reconstruction and the origins of federal intervention to protect blacks. Can you talk about what ensued after the Civil War?
Well, what ensued after the Civil War was the blacks were freed from slavery. Not all blacks were slaves, but the overwhelming majority of blacks were slaves. They were freed from slavery, but they received, to quote a title of a book by Eric Foner, they received nothing but freedom. They still were not cloaked with the equal protection of the law. So in 1865 and in 1866 and in 1867, black people suffered from all sorts of racially motivated violence. 1/10 of the black people who served in legislatures in the South during the Reconstruction era were themselves the victim of racially motivated violence. 1/10 of the people blacks who served in state legislatures.
Were there many blacks who served in state legislatures?
A substantial number. A substantial number, and they were the victims of racially motivated violence. Blacks who learned how to read were often targeted by the Ku Klux Klan as objects of racially motivated violence. And in fact, the 14th Amendment, which is the amendment which raised blacks to citizenship and which also cloaked all persons with the equal protection of the law. One of the reasons for passing the 14th Amendment was to enjoin the states to protect black people, because before then, black people were essentially outlaws, not because they had done anything wrong, but simply it was because many states... many people did not view black people as having a status which should entitle them to the equal protection of the law. And this still continues today. I mean, it's still the case today. There's been a lot of change. I don't want to make it seem as though we have had a static history. There has been a considerable change in the United States. But many people still complain, and often rightly so, that when African Americans are victimized by crime, it does not get the same amount of attention by newspapers and by radio stations and by television stations. It does not get the same amount of attention as when white people are victimized by crime. And this is a tendency that still remains with us.
Before we go into what is happening today, I did want to stay a bit in history, also since so much of today is rooted in what has happened over the last 200 years in this country, and talk not just about crime and also police, but about other kinds of law enforcement like the FBI. And you give a history, for example, of the FBI's relationship with Marcus Garvey.
That's right. One of the reasons why so many African Americans today are very skeptical about the administration of criminal justice is rooted in history. They know that many people who have struggled on behalf of African Americans have been targeted by law enforcement. And the agency that one agency that sticks out in the consciousness of African Americans is the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI. The FBI, under the leadership of J. Edgar Hoover, focused on black activists for several decades. Many people now, when they think of the FBI focusing on black activists, they think of the Black Panther Party and Martin Luther King. But actually, the history of it goes back much further in time. The FBI focused on, for instance, Marcus Garvey, and for racially motivated reasons, along with many other activists. And I, as you note, I relate this. This ugly side of our national history in my book.
Could you explain what they did to Marcus Garvey?
Well, with respect to Marcus Garvey, after J. Edgar Hoover focused on black activists, he thought that black people demanding their rights was itself a type of subversion. And inasmuch as Marcus Garvey was a firebrand black nationalist who was very critical of the United States, J. Edgar Hoover focused on Garvey and spent a lot of time and effort in trying to figure out some way to prosecute Garvey. At one point, for instance, the FBI tried to maintain a Mann Act case against Garvey. The Mann Act is the act which prohibits transporting women across state lines for immoral purposes. That did not pan out. The way in which the FBI finally got Garvey was on essentially a mail fraud case. The claim was that Garvey had duped investors in the Black Star lines. And there was a criminal prosecution, and Garvey was convicted. He served time in prison and was ultimately deported.
Deported to where?
He was deported, I believe, back to Jamaica.
What about how the Jim Crow laws got instituted, and then what happened to them? How legally they were abolished?
Well, the Jim Crow laws, and by Jim Crow laws, what we mean are laws which decreed that blacks and whites would have to be separated in every sphere of public interaction, from railroad cars to cemeteries to hospitals to prisons to telephone booths to cabs, you name it, there was separation of the races.
Apartheid.
Many people analogize it to apartheid. I sort of resist the analogy because in a way, apartheid was even worse than what occurred in the United States of America. After all, in the United States, Jim Crow, as terrible as it was limited to a section of the country. It was the section of the country, the American South, where the largest number of black people were. But there was at least some way that one could escape to some degree, whereas the apartheid system was more comprehensive than even the system that we had in the United States. But in any event, after the end of Reconstruction in the mid 1870s, until the 1950s. The idea of separating people on a racial basis was a very established institution in American life, and that policy existed until it was frontally challenged It was challenged actually throughout this period. Sometimes people talk about the civil rights movement as if it was only in the 1950s that African Americans and other people challenged the Jim Crow system. It was always under challenge. It so happened that in the 1950s there were finally the big breakthroughs, and it was in the 1950s and 1960s that separate but equal was finally overcome in the courts.
You also lay out the Emmett Till case, and I bet most white Americans would not know what that case was, and most black Americans would. It's one of those stories that shapes how African Americans perceive how they're dealt with in this country.
Well, I think you're right. One of the reasons why I spend a considerable amount of time in this book detailing the history and going into it with considerable detail is that nowadays people know a catchphrase. They know Emmett Till, and I think there's some people who know that something bad happened, or the Scottsboro Boys case. They know that there was a miscarriage of justice, but they don't know a whole lot more than that. And one of the things that I wanted to do for younger readers, perhaps, or for people who may have forgotten the facts of these cases, was to detail these cases and to set forth the way in which these cases are important to our present-day understanding of race and the criminal justice system. Now, the story of Emmett Till was the story of a youngster who had grown up in Chicago. He was a young teenager. He was 13 or 14 years of age. He was sent down to Mississippi to be with his relatives for a summer. And he had not really been schooled in the etiquette of the Jim Crow South. He was from Chicago. And he didn't know that there were certain things that you simply did not do, if you were black anyway, in the South. And one of the things that this youngster did, what Emmett Till did, was he went into a store, and he talked with a white woman who was the cashier, and he whistled at her on a dare. Just sort of a young teenager-type prank, just sort of whistled. This white woman told her husband about this, and her husband and a friend went to the home where Emmett Till was staying. They abducted Emmett Till, and at least according to them, they meant to maybe beat him and to scare him, but they ultimately decided to kill him. They killed him. The evidence of guilt was overwhelming. In fact, initially, the sheriff in this town in Mississippi and other law enforcement officials in Mississippi initially were in favor of the criminal prosecution because they thought that what had been done was atrocious. There was a change of feeling, however, when the NAACP got involved in the case. When the NAACP got involved in the case and other civil rights activists said, listen, this is not some sort of idiosyncratic episode. This is characteristic of the Jim Crow South. I mean, the killing of this youngster for having violated the etiquette of Jim Crow is what white racial oppression means in Mississippi in the 1950s. And when the civil rights activists said that, there was a sort of circling of the wagons in the white community in the South. And so the newspapers that had initially criticized the perpetrators of this deed either became silent or they said, we've got to teach the NAACP a lesson. And so there was this circling of the wagons. The lawyers for the men who were charged with the killing made an explicit appeal to racial solidarity, appeal to the all-white jury in Mississippi. And the jury acquitted the men. Immediately after their acquittal, by the way, they confessed their guilt to a journalist who paid them for the story. And they said, sure, yeah, we killed him. And the fact of the matter is, everybody knew that these men had perpetrated this foul deed.
Randall Kennedy, we have to leave now, but we'll continue this discussion later in the week. Professor Randall Kennedy teaches at Harvard Law School, formerly a law clerk to Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall. He just published a new book called Race, Crime, and the Law. It's published by Pantheon. If you'd like to get a copy of today's show, you can order a cassette by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Andy York engineered today's show out of the studios of WPFW in Washington, D.C. Errol Maitland is our engineer in New York, and our assistant producer, Julie Drizin, our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Now.